in the first 5 years. The Purpose-Driven Life was also on the New York Times bestseller list for over 90 weeks. And by 2019, 32 million copies had been sold in more than 85 languages. Rick Warren has been asked in an interview, why? Why do you think so many people have read this book? Do we have a few people who've read it here, perhaps? And he said, I think it's because spiritual emptiness is a universal disease. There's got to be more than this, we think. There's got to be more than getting up and going to work and coming home and watching TV and going to bed again and doing it all over again the next day. And he said, I think there's an inner desire to know that you are not an accident and that you matter and that you have a purpose. That's not just a spiritual yearning, of course, right? It's a human yearning. It's universal, a yearning to live a life with meaning and to live a life on purpose. So for the next few weeks, I want to invite you to think with me about your life purpose by asking three questions. One is, who am I? What's my story and my history? The second is, who are my traveling companions on this journey and why do we need each other? Who have I been given and who do I perhaps need to reach out to travel with me? And finally, what's your why? What purpose, for what purpose are you here on this earth? This is not a self-help exercise. You can go to the bookstore, right, and find all sorts of self-help books. But in religious and spiritual language, the name for purpose is call. This is about God's call upon your life right now. When I was 20, I remember sitting in my college cafeteria and hearing United Methodist Bishop give a definition of God's call that has stuck with me ever since. God calls you to that place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Friends, what this means is that we are all on God's call list. Everybody, pastors, yes. Teachers, yes. Plumbers, yes. Engineers, yes. Musicians, yes. Stay-at-home parents, yes. Salespersons, yes. Retirees, yes. Grandparents, yes. Every name is in God's context. Everyone has something that makes their heart glad, right? Just think about what makes your heart sing. And everyone has a gift that a hurting world needs. And there is no end to the need in the world today, right? Before you and I were born, God was weaving God's purpose into us. God's grace was at work within us. That's what we believe in United Methodism when we talk about the prevenient grace that was with us before we were born. Our names were already being written on God's heart. This does not mean, of course, as I like to remind you, that there was a map that detailed everything, who we were to marry, what job we were to have, what joy we would have, what suffering we would endure, what we would eat today for lunch. God doesn't work like that. Free will and human choice and circumstances often beyond our control play a huge part in the way our lives unfold, in the way God calls us, in our purpose for living. The story of Moses is probably one of the best known Bible stories about God's call. Generations know it, not just because it's in the Bible, right? But because we know it from the movie, The Ten Commandments. Some of us remember when that came out. Some of us remember watching it, and Charlton Heston looms larger than life. For some of us, we may have also watched the 1998 film, the DreamWorks film, Prince of Egypt. But to understand why God called Moses, you have to understand who Moses is. When we meet Moses in our reading today that Christine read for us, he's already lived a full life, and his own personal story is set against this backdrop of political power grabbing and nationhood and genocide as well. The first book of the Bible, Genesis, sets in motion the story of God's people, including all of Jacob's descendants. And by the time we get around to the second book of the Bible, Exodus, which is, if you want to go home this afternoon, just read the first three chapters. There's some fascinating stuff there. It's not, some of the parts of the Bible, I will say, are a bit, they would put you to sleep at night. But Exodus, first three chapters and beyond, there's a lot of good stuff there. So when we meet Moses in our reading today, the Egyptians had already begun to see the Hebrew people as a threat and were kind of tightening their control on them, forcing them to work as slaves. And eventually the threat became so real that Pharaoh commanded that all the baby boys be killed. And in order to escape death, you remember this from your Sunday school stories perhaps, Moses' mother placed her baby boy in a basket and set him adrift in the Nile. He was rescued by the Pharaoh's daughter and brought up in the palace as a royal prince. And as an adult, Moses reacted to this unfair treatment of his own people and killed an Egyptian guard. And when it became clear that his true identity was known, Moses fled in fear to escape Pharaoh, who was surely going to kill him. He went into exile in the land of Midian. He became a shepherd. He married. He settled down, and life was good. But back in Egypt, not so much. The Israelites, we read in the Bible, were groaning under their oppression, under their slavery, and their cry for help rose up to God. And we read that God heard their groaning. God hears our prayers. God heard their groaning and remembered his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And one day when Moses was tending sheep, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a bush caught fire. That would catch anybody's attention. And the voice of God came from the bush calling him by name, "Moses, here I am," said Moses, like a child answering the roll call at school. And the voice said, "Remove your sandals, for you are standing on holy ground." I remember in one church I served in Rogers Park, we had an Asian Indian congregation that also worshiped there in that particular church. And it was the custom in that particular congregation to always remove their shoes when they were anywhere near the altar of the sanctuary. I see some of you nodding your heads, and you know that tradition, as a reminder that they were standing on holy ground and that God might indeed just speak to them. So we see here God bending down. "I have observed the misery of my people. I've known their sufferings. I will send you to Pharaoh," God says to Moses, "to bring my people out of Egypt." So at this point, Moses basically answers with the words, "You want me to do what?" "Who am I," Moses asked God, "that I should go to Pharaoh?" And of course, from everything we know about Moses, we know he's perfect for the job. It's precisely because of who he is, his identity as a Hebrew, raised as an Egyptian, his story of being saved as a baby, his passion for the underdog, his family. It is because of who he is that God needs him to be the one to help save God's people. "Who am I?" Moses asked. And so as Moses stands there, asking this of God, barefoot before the burning bush, full of doubts and questions, God says to him, "I will be with you." Remember, we hear that all throughout Scripture. When Mary finds out she's pregnant with Jesus, "I will be with you," God says. God's calling on Moses' life is not about whether it will all turn out okay. God's call to Moses and to us is about whether or not we're willing to go with God to those places where people are hurting, where people are broken, where people are in need of good news and deliverance from all that holds them captive. "I will be with you," God says. It's easy to kind of lift up heroes of the Bible like Moses or the prophet Jeremiah or others we know, like Martin Luther King, for instance, and think of them as these big people. I could never fill those shoes. But at this moment in Moses' life, we see him in a place of doubting and questioning God and saying, "Who am I? Who am I to be the one to fulfill your call?" You may have heard the story of Martin Luther King when he was only 27 years old. We think about him in big terms, big hero, the "I Have a Dream" speech, but back in Montgomery, Alabama, when he was just starting out his ministry, and he was only 27 years old, 2 years into his role of the pastor at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. He'd been leading the Montgomery bus boycott, and that decision to lead that had led a series of death threats to happen, phone calls and mail to be delivered to his residents, as many as 30 to 40 calls daily, often in the middle of the night, the phone ringing. And normally King would put the phone down and go back to sleep, but one call on the night of January 27th, 1956, stood out. King's wife, Coretta, and their 10-week-old daughter, Yolanda, slept in the bedroom nearby. And the voice on the other end of the line said a horrible word that I won't say here. "We're tired of your mess. And if you aren't out of this town in 3 days, we're going to blow up your house and blow your brains out." Obviously shaken, King went to the kitchen, made himself a cup of coffee, and buried his face in his hands. And he began to pray. He said, "Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right, but I must confess I'm losing my courage. I'm losing my courage." And he later told this story many times, and he explained what happened next. And he said, "I could hear an inner voice saying to me, 'Martin Luther, stand up for truth. Stand up for justice. Stand up for righteousness.' And the fear ceased, but not the threats. They kept coming. There was a bomb a few weeks later. No one inside was hurt, thankfully. And all those years later, in the parsonage of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, you can still see gnashes in the concrete, traces of the bomb. We know the rest of the story, of course, and how King became a giant. But we may not always know that with God's call comes those moments. Who am I? Who am I to do this? Who am I to save your people? Who am I to follow you? Most of us don't get a burning bush, do we? That would be nice, a very clear sign. Some of us may have had a voice. Maybe we've had a conversation in the middle of the night over a cup of coffee in the kitchen with God. But most of the time, probably, we may feel like we're putting out fires rather than having the fire of God come to us and sort of going from crisis to crisis. Anybody feel like that? I was reminded as I was listening to the stories, with September 11th being midweek this week, of the crisis that was that day and the calls that came for action with no time to ask, "Who am I?" 18 years ago, it wasn't a conversation. It was just a no-brainer for many who responded to the call. Just this week, I heard an interview with 53-year-old Andrew Milchinski, who had 3 friends killed on 9/11. And in the interview, he said, "Every year I sit and I listen to the names being read." You know, they read the names of those who lost their lives. This year, for the first time, the remains of Milchinski's friend Michael Haub have been identified, and there was a ceremony in which his name was read and his body finally laid to rest. I heard that there are still 1,109 names of folks who died there at the World Trade Center site whose remains have yet to be identified. Their names are still read, of course. The call went out that day, and Milchinski talks about his friend Mike responding to go down and help. And he said Mike basically led a life of service, serving people. He said, "We all know, as a fellow firefighter, I know that there was no place else that he wanted to be that day, regardless of whether he was going to lose his life or not. He wanted to be there. He wanted to be there." Friends, what we hear in the stories of September 11th over and over again, and we need to tell these stories every year to help process our grief. Some of you, I know, have been touched deeply by that day 18 years ago. But what we hear in these stories is what we also hear in the call of Moses and the call of folks like Martin Luther King and the call of Mary, the mother of Jesus, and the call of Desmond Tutu and Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman and you and me. God uses us right where we are, our story, our current reality, our gifts, our history, to save lives, to bring hope, to show kindness, and to change the world. God uses who we are, right where we are, to remind us and others of whose we are. I heard this song years ago, and this is part of the lyrics, and it's a helpful reminder for me. There is so much to do in this world, whether it be in our own circle or, as I like to say, way beyond the walls, right? God's call on Moses' life was very clear. Sometimes it's not so clear for us. I cannot do all the good that the world needs, but the world needs all the good that I can do. Who am I, Moses asked, to be the one to go to Pharaoh? Who am I? Who are you to think that you can help someone in their time of need? Who are you to think that you could save a life? Who are you to think that your gifts, your talents could be used to change the world? Who are you to think that the small things you do when done with great love really, really matter? But if not you or me, then who? Friends, God is inviting you and me to live a life on purpose and with purpose, to know who we are and whose we are, to know that we belong to a God who calls us by name, who wants us to be rooted and grounded in a love story that will not let us go, who will not fail to equip us for the work that is ours in the world or in our families or our workplaces or at Trinity or whatever it is where God's people need us and are hurting, who calls out to those places and people today, even now. Maybe there is a burning bush waiting for you just around the corner. I hope you'll tell me about it, because it does happen. And God does come to us in that way. Maybe it's a still small voice. Maybe it's simply a reminder from God to you that no matter what you are going through right now, no matter how God is leading you, God's promise is that God will be with us. So listen for the voice. Look out for the light and the fire of God. Perhaps remove your shoes, for you will indeed be standing on holy ground, and God will call you by name. Amen.